Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument in the January term is Colleen Anderson Sanford, appellant, versus T. Denny Sanford, appellee. For the appellant is Mr. Thomas Welk, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, Mr. Sanford, is Mr. Edwin Evans, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Welk, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Mr. Evans. Also today with me, members of the court, is my client, Colleen Sanford, and members of her family. This is a domestic relations case that will determine the enforceability of a prenuptial agreement signed in 1995. The appellant contends that the prenuptial agreement is enforceable both as to unenforceable as to alimony and property. The appellee contends that the prenuptial agreement is enforceable as to both. Retired Justice Amundson, sitting as the circuit judge below, found the agreement unenforceable as to alimony but not as to property. The appellate requests that you determine that the agreement is void and unenforceable and remand to the trial court for an award under for property and alimony, and that the trial court not be bound by the prenuptial agreement.
Now, there's no question of fact. This is purely a question of law, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Right.
And in the case below, it's de novo by this court because it involves an interpretation of contract. The procedural history is quite brief in this case. Mr. Sanford commenced this action in January of 2003. Mrs. Sanford answered and counterclaimed for divorce based on adultery and extreme cruelty. After the initial pleadings were filed, there was extensive interrogatories and discovery requests served because of the complex nature of Mr. Sanford's financial holdings. Mr. Sanford provided some limited information but refused to provide much of the information, contending that the prenuptial agreement was enforceable and that the information was not relevant. Motions to compel were filed in the trial court below, but were deferred by the trial court by the agreement of the parties to address the enforceability of the prenuptial agreement. Cross motions for summary judgment were filed by both in regard to the respective positions. There were depositions taken of the parties, but the depositions were limited to primarily the execution of the prenuptial agreement. After the trial court's ruling, Justice Amundson certified under Rule 54B an appeal to this court, and alternatively suggested an intermediate appeal because of the importance of the issue. This court granted the appeal, the intermediate appeal. This case comes on a record below where Mr. Sanford has admitted his adultery, and my client contends that not only was adultery, but there was physical and verbal abuse. The parties were two people that were of legal age. Denny was a sophisticated businessman who had a multi-million dollar net worth. He had been previously married with two adult children at the time he met Colleen. Colleen had never been married. The parties never had children. Colleen, through her entire life, was a very self-reliant person working through her teenage life and into her adult life. And she worked as a dental assistant around the Sioux Falls area, then eventually moved to Indianapolis with one of her sisters. And then became an owner in a home accessory store, which eventually was sold. And she met Denny at a time when she returned to Sioux Falls, and she was going into a new career as a potential financial planner. After she met Denny, they started a relationship, and eventually they moved in together for a period of about 7 years. The parties also had a couple of instances. Actually, there were three instances where the relationship prior to marriage was almost broken up. The last time, Colleen said that she wanted to return to Indianapolis. Denny asked her to stay, begged her to stay, and prepared a non-marital agreement that provided certain monies of $2,000 per month for her personal needs and to maintain a Sioux Falls home. The net worth of Mr. Sanford is substantial. There was a prenuptial agreement that was entered into. The agreement was first presented to Mrs. Sanford about 5 months before the marriage. Both parties were represented by counsel. And when counsel negotiated the agreement, the template became the non-marital agreement. And essentially, the negotiation between counsel became the non, extrapolating from the non-marital agreement. During the time that the negotiations were taking place, Colleen was at home. She would talk to her lawyer. There would be discussions at home where Mr. Sanford would be angry. And it became clear that he wanted her to sign the agreement. Two receptions had been planned, a trip to Europe. There was some negotiation, but the disclosure of Mr. Sanford regarding his net worth did not occur until the day that it was signed. And she saw it at the moment she signed it and disclosed a substantial and complex net worth. But she was represented by a lawyer, and it was signed. She was told by her lawyer that it wasn't enforceable in substantial part.
That being the alimony part, or did he not specify?
That was not specified in the deposition below, Mr. Chief Justice.
All right.
Is it an issue whether or not she was coerced into signing this? Is that still an issue no matter what this court decides?
The issue, Your Honor, Justice Meyer-Henry, involves two issues of procedural unconscionability and substantive unconscionability. Insofar as the procedural unconscionability, we're saying that because they were kept in the dark until the last moment, even though she was represented by counsel, and that he insisted that she sign it, and that there was the wedding was planned, so that there are issues regarding procedural unconscionability. I've also raised in our briefs the issue which is new to this court, and that is substantive unconscionability. That even if there is procedural requirements of the premarital statute were met, that there's a line of cases out there where some courts have looked at the time that the agreement is sought to be enforced, not at the time that was sought to be executed, and to look at what happened during the marriage. And one of our arguments that's being made to this court, that even if there was nothing found to be an error from a procedural, that this court ought to adopt a new rule to look at substantive unconscionability.
Well, that would nullify the contract then. We're turning ourselves into a court of equity, aren't we?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because it would allow you to look, as other courts have done, at the time of enforcement to see if there's been a substantial change in the circumstances during the marriage.
Sounds like the criteria for alimony.
Pardon?
Sounds a little bit like the criteria
for
alimony.
It does, but the cases, the courts that have adopted the substantive unconscionability arguments have said that it's patently unfair and inequitable that if someone enters into a marriage with a small amount of net worth, or even maybe in this case, one where it increases 5-10 times, and the agreement is looked at the time of enforcement to look at what the net worth was at that time, and if it was substantively unconscionable, which we suggest in this instance that the payments provided on the agreement are less than 1% of the net worth was in the record as of 2002. And I think there is a situation that where you can look at and say, when it is so inherently inequitable that from a substantive standpoint, it's unconscionable. And I think below 1% is substantively unconscionable.
What happened if his net worth had gone the other way?
Then the court, if it had substantially gone the other way, inequitable, the court, if you adopt that rule, Your Honor, it must go both ways.
All right.
Is that an issue, though, of beauty is in the eye of the beholder? I mean, it seems to me that everyone could disagree about what's substantively or what's unfair, or I don't know where you draw that line.
Well, it's no different than what you look at punitive damages. It's no different than a lot of things that you look at. It's sort of like when you look at it and you see, is 1% of the net worth, is that substantively unconscionable? I don't know where the bright line is, and I'm not sure you want to draw that bright line, but I suggest respectfully that less than 1% is under the bright line.
But shouldn't that issue be tried? Those two issues, shouldn't that be tried before you get to the legal question involved in this case as to whether or not alimony or support agreements are unconscionable, or whether or not property is?
No, Justice Sabres, because unconscionability is a question of law. You will determine that. You can look at what that is there, and as a matter of substance, I mean, you could remand it back and say, we'll look at it. But at the end analysis, it lies with this court.
Well, did Justice Amundson reach that?
No, he did not reach that. His reasoning, and we'll get into the agreement, was that since 1978, when this court decided Connolly, that it was to provide for alimony in a prenuptial agreement is void and unenforceable. And he just said, he looked at what the legislature did in 1989, which the legislature consciously did not adopt in the premarital, uniform premarital agreement, a provision that would allow a modification, and said, the set of laws clear in this state, both by this court and by the legislature, and therefore it's void and unenforceable. What he then did is then he went to the severability issue, and that is, he said that I find the property agreement is severable and I'm going to enforce it. He made an interesting comment, it is just in the last part of his opinion, where he said that the reason that it was going to be enforceable is because of Connolly, that in Connolly you said it was divisible. Well, if you look at Connolly, the last paragraph that was then written by then Chief Justice Woolman, he remanded it back. The court did not analyze the severability issue in that. But Justice Amundson also said, I find some of the provisions nonsensical in the agreement. And they are nonsensical. If you read the agreement and try to figure it out, it's a very complex set of terms that, depending on who initiates the divorce and who is awarded the divorce, certain payments are provided. And it's especially confusing in this instance where Mr. Sanford initiated it, my client counterclaimed, and he has admitted fault. Now, if you go back and look at the prenuptial agreement in the context of the procedural history of this case, it becomes hopefully confused. In fact, as Justice Amundson pointed out, why it's nonsensical is that even my client is not at fault. She gets less property because she's not at fault.
But haven't we said repeatedly in our contract cases it's not the job of this court to rescue a person from the bad bargain they made in a contract?
In commercial settings, not in marital settings.
Well, here, okay, but they had advice of counsel.
They had advice of counsel, but Your Honor, as you said in Green, in your opinion, you said that the marital relationship is a very special relationship, and it is. And we have never recognized in the law of this state the ability to contract away support. That's never been the law in this state since Connolly has been decided. And what Mr. Sanford did, he's a very sophisticated businessman, he looked at the risk of the marital relationship no different than a commercial transaction. And when I took his deposition, he said, and I asked him point blank, and it's in the brief, did you believe that all the economic consequences of this relationship were predetermined? And his answer was definitely. He saw this as an ordinary commercial transaction in which he could determine all of the economic consequences of this relationship. This then would allow him to act with impunity in regard to adultery, abuse, because the economic consequences have been settled. And that's the issue, that's the policy issue that's confronting this court. Is, are you going to allow that? Are you going to change the direction of the law of the state that's existed for 27 years and say that somehow alimony should be enforceable in a premarital agreement?
Well, Mr. Welk, even at the time this agreement was executed, Sanford's counsel must have had to have told him that the alimony provision wasn't enforceable.
Well, we don't know that in the record. I assume he had competent counsel, Your Honor, but he pushed the envelope. He did not draft this agreement, which he surely could have done, to allocate a certain amount of payments to alimony and a certain amount of payments to property. He didn't. In fact, the key provision in the agreement says, Colleen shall make no other claim against Denny in the event of the dissolution of the marriage for any reason in the nature of support, alimony, property, settlement, or otherwise. He integrated the two. He purposely pushed the envelope to say, this is it.
Well, then why did they include the severability clause in the agreement?
Well, it's a standard provision that would be in any contract at the end. But the question the court has, if you would say the agreement is enforceable, how much is it? How much is alimony? How much is property? I would suggest that it would be difficult for anyone to discern. If you say this severable as to property, are you going to say the entire amount of the property, this is going to be awarded for property? The way it's drafted, and in the context of the procedural history of this case, I think it's hopelessly confused and should be void and unenforceable. And so this court has to look at the squarely, this case presents the opportunity to squarely revisit, as Mr. Evans has indicated, the policy of the state. Are you going to continue the law that's existed for 27 years in this state or not? And I suggest it's the wrong case. This court looked at subsequent to Connolly to Ryken and Green, and even in the Billion case, you held that the right to support is an inalienable right that cannot be transferred. Now, this court has looked
given the fact that there are statutes addressing some of these issues, are you one floor too low in making your argument?
No, I think Mr. Evans is one floor too low.
All right.
I think he should have been on the third floor. The policy of this state has been set by you, and it's been set by the legislature. Indisputable what the policy of this state is. If that's going to change, it will start here, or it will start up there. But the policy lies with this body, with the body upstairs. And so you're going to have to tell the citizens of this state that we are changing the public policy that's existed for 27 years. One of the things that I believe that you need to do under the analysis, which Justice Amundson did not do, is to undertake the analysis under your Thunderstick decision as to the issue of the enforceability of severability. Thunderstick was the case where it was decided where there were provisions in a lease, for a real estate lease, that exceeded the 20-year provision in South Dakota, and there was one 10-year and two 10-year extensions. And this court set forth a clear test when it's confronted with a contractual clause that's both enforceable and unenforceable. Justice Amundson did not address the Thunderstick analysis. It set forth in our briefs that the court must look at whether the parts, and the parts I'm referring to, is it enforceable as to property or as to alimony, are the parts' performances separable, which I claim they're not in this case. I don't know how you can discern their separability. They must be agreed equivalents. I don't think you can discern that. They must not be integrated in a scheme to contravene public policy. This was clearly an effort to contravene the existing public policy that existed in 1995, and the parties seeking the enforcement must not engage in serious misconduct. In this case, adultery, alleged verbal and physical abuse is serious misconduct.
Now, when Justice Amundson looked at this, he determined that it was severable.
Yes.
And what did he indicate then, which part he viewed as property as opposed to alimony?
No, Justice.
So you never got to that?
Never got to that point. Actually, if you read the last part of his opinion, it's about two lines. And he referred to Connolly and said they, you know, it was divisible in Connolly. But the court never did anything about the divisibility. It just, in Connolly, this court just said void, unenforceable, and remanded back. So, no, we did not have the benefit of that. And one...
Well, if that's the case, then the entire amount that's set forth in the prenup under Justice Amundson's analysis has to be allocated to property.
The logical extension of his analysis, Justice Center, I believe would have to be that. Because there's no other analysis one could do under the agreement. But he did not give us the benefit of that wisdom. But I mean, I don't know what other logical conclusion one can reach. Because he said it's void and it's severable as to property. But he never went the next step and said that's all going to be awarded toward property. Another point that I would not want to make in regard to public policy, Your Honors, and that is that I suggest that it's not time to change and the public policy of this state. But if you have that desire to address that issue, then I respectfully suggest this must be prospective in application. You have a series of rules that when you look at an issue, if you change public policy as to whether you're going to make it prospective or retrospective.
Are you talking about alimony now?
I'm talking about, should you decide, Your Honor, to determine to change the course of public policy and say that one can allow alimony to be addressed in the premarital agreement, that would be a substantial change in the law of the state, and that it ought to be retrospective and not apply to this agreement. It should be something that parties in the South Dakota would know your decision and would be addressed on a prospective basis. You've got a myriad of agreements out there that people have addressed, have negotiated under the Connolly decision and its progeny. And it would be unfair, patently unfair, to the people that looked at those and negotiated those agreements to do anything but apply such a substantive change in policy except on a prospective basis. So in summary, Your Honor, we would request that you remand the case back to Justice Amundson for a full determination of a property and alimony award. This case represents an opportunity to reaffirm your policy as to that alimony and support occupies a separate and distinct and special place in our contract law in South Dakota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Welk. Mr. Evans, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, Mrs. Sanford.
Before you get into your argument, do you agree with the opposing counsel? There's no question of fact.
There's no question of fact, Your Honor, unless you were to, as a court, adopt
you're writing in the Green case where you concurred and dissented and talking about post-marital misconduct and the role that that would play in determining conscionability or unconscionability of a prenuptial agreement. If you the Uniform Act says you look at unconscionability at the time the agreement is executed, and post-marital conduct doesn't influence it, which only makes sense because fault usually going to be an issue in divorce cases. And if you could avoid a prenuptial agreement by just alleging fault, prenuptial agreements would become a nullity. And so if you were going to do that, then we did agree with Justice Amundson's suggestion that we were not going to get into post-marital issues, and Mr. Welk alluded to that. And so I'm a little surprised in his brief, in his statement of the case and statement of facts, that he talks about all of this post-marital conduct when it was agreed we were not going to get into that. We were going to determine the validity of the prenuptial agreement only. So it's a question of law unless the court were going to get into post-marital misconduct, because we admitted adultery, but we did not admit anything else, and we also alleged, obviously, grounds in our divorce for fault on the other side as well.
So we, if we were to adopt that theory, then it would have to go back for findings.
Yes, but I would also say if you adopt that theory, it's directly contrary to the Uniform Act that says you determine conscionability at the time. And if you look at the other 41 states that allow premarital agreements to control not only property but alimony, in all of those jurisdictions, nobody looks at post-marital fault, because again, that would make the agreement a nullity. It would throw it into an area of, we're back into arguing about fault and alimony, and the agreements would become useless and wouldn't fulfill the purpose, the favored purpose, that they've come to enjoy in the society today. Going back, Your Honors, briefly, the facts that are pertinent facts, not the ones in the appellant's brief, but the pertinent facts as set out by Justice Amundson, the undisputed material facts in this case on which he based his award of summary judgment. The year is 1987. Denny is in his mid-50s. This is his second marriage. He had a long-term first marriage of some 20 years. He has two children from his first marriage. He has considerable wealth by anyone's standards. Mrs. Sanford, she's approximately 15 years younger, in her late 30s. She's never been married, but she's lived together with someone for 11 years. Had a long-term relationship there. In essence, you have two middle-aged adults with previous long-term relationships. It's not a first marriage. There's no plans to have children. They begin living together in 1988 after dating for a few months. She's concerned about her security. She says, what happens if this relationship ends and I'm left high and dry? So in response to that, Mr. Sanford prepares a non-marital partnership agreement, giving her monthly payments for household expenses. If the relationship ends, she gets additional payments. Clean admits, Mrs. Sanford admits, the sole purpose of that contract was to protect her, and she wanted that. Without that agreement, of course, and without common law marriage in South Dakota, she'd be entitled to nothing under the law. Also, that agreement contains, similar to the premarital agreement in this case, a waiver of any interest in each other's property. Mrs. Sanford wants to get married, and after living together for about 8 years, Mr. Sanford agrees to get married. He brings up the issue of a premarital agreement or prenuptial agreement in the spring of 1995, 5 months before the wedding. His lawyer, Gary Timpson, drafts a proposed agreement. Mr. Sanford tells Mrs. Sanford to hire a lawyer to review the proposed agreement. She hires Brian Stewart based on a recommendation of her sister. Not a deal where somebody sent her, she picked her own lawyer. She admits to the following facts, and bear in mind that she can't claim a version of facts more favorable than her own. All of these are admitted by her. Number one, Mr. Sanford would not get married without a prenuptial agreement. She admits that. The purpose of the agreement was to provide and protect for his children of his first marriage. Natural for parents to want to provide and leave their estates and their wealth to their children, not second spouses. Mrs. Sanford admits she'd heard of prenuptial agreements, especially for second marriages. She knew at least one couple that had such an agreement. She met with her attorney 4 or 5 times regarding the prenuptial agreement before signing it. It was negotiated and changes were made at her attorney's request. She and Mr. Sanford argued about the terms of it. And yes, they argued, and he would get mad when she proposed certain changes that he didn't want. So she knew he felt strongly about this. She knew he wouldn't get married without it. She recalls no changes that she proposed to the agreement that were not made. She proposed changes, and they were made. The prenuptial agreement significantly increases the financial security that was provided for her in the previous non-marital partnership agreement. It was incremental. The longer the marriage, the more she would receive. Attached to the prenuptial agreement was Denny's financial disclosure, revealing his net worth. It was substantial by anybody's standards. It was a typical financial statement. It didn't provide boxes of backup data, but it was a financial statement like any of us would submit to a bank. Mrs. Sanford says she didn't see it till she saw it. She didn't see it until she signed the agreement, and she saw no backup documentation. She never asked for more time to review either the agreement or his financial disclosure. She was represented by a lawyer. He never asked for more time or more information. She never asked for any backup information. Neither did her lawyer. Although she believes the financial disclosure may not be fair and reasonable, she has no evidence to suggest otherwise.
Is it in the record that the lawyer saw the actual document before she signed it?
Yes, it is. If you look at the correspondence attached to Mr. Timpson's affidavit, there's letters back and forth saying enclosed is a revised draft agreement with changes, look at it and call me. And the last letter says that I'm sending you the revised agreement. You already have a copy of the financial statement of Mr. Sanford that should be attached to this. And so the lawyer had it a few days before it was signed.
So there was a short time between when it was signed and the wedding, apparently. There had been drafts flowing back and forth for some time.
Yes, and it was signed 5 weeks before the wedding. Over 5 weeks before the wedding, and there were drafts floating back and forth for a month before that. So this whole process, you know, took over a month, the drafting and the back and forth between the lawyers. She admits she signed it voluntarily. So in response to Justice Marhenry's thing about coercion, she said, I voluntarily signed it. And again, she can't claim a version of the facts more favorable than herself. She admits the prenuptial agreement encouraged their marriage because Mr. Sanford wouldn't have gotten married without one. So actually, in this case, it encouraged them to get married. Equally important, she admits the agreement did not cause or didn't contribute to the break of their marriage. Mr. Timpson's affidavit indicates there was no deadline for her to sign, there was no pressure, there was no unwillingness to provide additional information. There were three drafts exchanged between Mr. Stewart and Mr. Timpson. Regarding the financial disclosure, the burden of proof under the Uniform Act is on them to show that it's unconscionable or to show the financial disclosure was inadequate or not full and complete. The burden's on them. They have no evidence. The only evidence is an affidavit by Mr. Sanford's CPA that prepares his tax returns that says that he gifted some of his stock and his primary asset in one of his banks to his children in 1994 and 1995, and that the valuations that he used and those returns were audited by the IRS.
Do you want to bring your water up?
Thank you.
You bet.
Those returns were audited by the IRS, and that the value that he placed on his stock for the gift purposes was less than what he disclosed in his financial statement. So the CPA says actually he is being more generous on his net worth as disclosed. So we then move to the post-marital relationship and lifestyle. Mrs. Sanford makes much of that. Mr. Sanford is wealthy. It's not disputed. That's why he wanted a prenuptial agreement. The mere fact you're wealthy doesn't deny you the same rights that anyone else has. That's the reason for prenuptial agreements, is to protect wealth, especially in second marriage situations. And according to both Mr. and Mrs. Sanford, there wouldn't have been a marriage without one. Now she wants the court to relieve her of her written obligation, her contract that she entered into, and to redraw it because she thinks she could have made a better deal, when in essence she couldn't, because without one, there would have been no marriage in the first place.
What about the agreement itself and the lack of any kind of specific reference to this is alimony and this is property?
Okay, you know, the severability issue. And to address that, Your Honor, I think that the terms property settlement, as used in the agreement, or property division, as used by South Dakota law, and alimony are clearly severable. They're separate objects. First of all, there's a severability provision in the agreement itself. If any part of it is void, the rest of it's valid. South Dakota law is similar.
You agree with Mr. Welk then that even though Justice Amundson didn't say so, if the support or the alimony provision were voided and Justice Amundson's affirmed on that, that all of the terms that relate to compensation in the agreement then have to be termed property?
Yes. And I think that only makes sense if you think about it for a minute, because as I recall, and I was trying to think about this last night, as I recall, Your Honors, when you set alimony, you consider the property award in determining alimony. So in this case, if Justice Amundson is affirmed in total, and the court decides that we're going to follow the minority view that alimony cannot be waived in a prenuptial or premarital agreement, then all of the money set aside for her would be attributed to a property division or property settlement.
Why couldn't you argue that the agreement encompassed both property and alimony, and therefore the monthly payments have to be divided? A portion of the monthly payment has to be considered alimony and therefore voided, and the remainder of the monthly payment has to be considered property. Why couldn't that be a reasonable interpretation?
It could be, but I think that, you know, then you're into apportionment, and then you get an ambiguous agreement. I mean, from my standpoint, does that create an ambiguity as to how much is attributable to what? I mean, certainly the court has the power to do it, because the court has the power to, in any divorce, to set property division and to set alimony.
There's nothing in the agreement that, I mean, you're conceding that point.
I'm conceding that point only because I think that when you then set alimony, you look at the amount that is awarded under property.
Right, but I mean, there's nothing in the agreement itself that helps us. You're saying, well, we have to logically say it's property. But nothing in the agreement really says that.
That's true. And obviously the court, as a court of equity, could say we're going to determine a portion of this, like we're going to say that the 7 years that you get to live in the $250,000 townhome is property settlement. The cash payments of some $48,000 a year is more of an alimony or something.
But okay, and that's what's troubling me about this then. Because the agreement doesn't specify it, what do you say to the point that the agreement can't be really severed unless we are going to play, Alexander and just cut the knot?
Because I think that if you have a portion under South Dakota law, if you have a portion of a contract, if a contract has several distinct objects, this is SDCL 53-5-4, several distinct objects, and this does, it has a distinct object of alimony, has a distinct object of property settlement, and one or more are lawful and one or more are unlawful, then you uphold the lawful parts and you void the unlawful parts. You don't void the whole thing.
But when it's intermixed, I mean, this $4,000 a month payment is obviously intended to cover everything.
Yes.
So it's mixed. How do we divide that?
So you give them the benefit of the best of both worlds by saying that we're voiding the alimony and all of this has to be towards property settlement. No different than Conley. Read the language in Conley and it's identical to this contract. In Conley, there was one paragraph and it said it's understood and agreed by and between the parties here too that each of them relinquishes and releases the other from any and all claims of support and from any and all interest in the property of the other. Both in one sentence. And then it set it out and this court said it's void as to alimony, it's valid as to property division, and referred it back. Exactly the same.
Then if the trial court goes back and revisits the alimony or the support, do you agree that he looks at all of the property that Denny Sanford has, including the amounts that he's paying as property from the premarital agreement?
I think that for purposes of alimony, you look at what she gets as way as property as a result of the divorce, and then certainly you look at his standard of life. But remember, alimony is to just provide support for the spouse. It's not to divide a 50-50 piece of the pie. It's to provide necessary support.
All right. But is the trial court entitled then to see the full extent of the present net worth in order to determine that figure, to determine the standard of living?
Well, I don't know that alimony entitles you to the same standard of living, but the trial court, it would be up to him to decide how much information he needed. And Justice Amundson said, I'll cross that bridge when I get to it. I mean, I personally don't think, I mean, one of the reasons of the prenuptial agreement is to not spend hundreds of thousands of dollars going out and having teams of people come in and evaluate the value of each and every business and to look at every asset and decide the value of that asset. I mean, literally, if you did that, that would be hundreds of thousands of dollars to do a comprehensive review like that. And quite frankly, my position with Justice Amundson was, if you have a financial statement that shows a considerable net worth, and you're going to decide alimony to provide basic support for the other person to meet her needs of living, that certainly, do you need all of that detailed information, or can't you just look at the financial statement and say, I have enough information? And even if it's off by 10 or 20%, given the wealth, it isn't going to make any difference.
In all fairness, in relation to the unconscionability issue, shouldn't that financial statement be disclosed 2 to 3 weeks in advance of requiring somebody to sign or not sign?
I'm not aware of any law that says that. I'm aware that she was represented by a lawyer that didn't ask for any more time. You know, and I would suggest to you that, you know, perhaps I submit financial statements to other people and they don't necessarily need 2 or 3 weeks to make a decision or whatever as to whether that's sufficient or whether they need more information. I mean, we've all gone to the bank with a financial statement and they haven't said we need 2 weeks to look at it or whatever. And obviously Mrs. Sanford isn't a banker, but she was represented by a competent lawyer, and there was never a time, there was never a deadline set, none at all. The fact that she saw it the day she signed it was her choice. She came in, she saw it, she signed it. That was her choice. She didn't say, can I have more time? And so the fact that she elected to sign it the day she saw it, I don't think should be held against Mr. Sanford when there was no deadline or whatsoever. Thunderstick.
I need to ask you procedurally now, how does this issue get to this court? The appellant is arguing that the whole thing should be voided. Are you saying that Justice Amundson's opinion should be affirmed, or did you cross appeal?
We cross appealed and said the whole thing should be valid, and that the time has come for this court in the 21st century to let adults contract, especially in second marriages and situations like this, and decide for themselves. And the court should not interject themselves. That's what the commentators believe. That's what the uniform law says. That's the favored view. All of the recent decisions in the last 10 years, all of them, say that adults should be able to decide that.
Don't we have to effectively overrule some of our statutes, though, to accomplish that?
No, because those statutes are all relate to agreements between husbands and wives. And here you have a premarital agreement, so all of that duty between a husband and a wife to support each other, that's all true. But we're talking about a premarital agreement that precedes that.
What about the statute that grants the authority to a court to award alimony? What are we just saying, well, that doesn't mean what it says?
No, you still have power and authority to award alimony, but you're recognizing the rights of the party to enter into a private contract, and you're just going to honor that contract and say that one of the parties has agreed to waive alimony in a premarital agreement, and that's not against public policy, and that's something that two adults in the 21st century should be able to do.
Wasn't the legislature, though, just unmistakably clear as to their wish on this when they stripped out the provision of the Uniform Act?
In 1980, that
would have allowed an alimony agreement. Here, a Uniform Act is submitted to the legislature that expressly allows these alimony agreements, and the legislature goes in and surgically strips that piece out and passes everything else. To me, that's an unmistakable signal.
I agree that in 1989, the legislature decided not to do that. They also decided, you know, the act also says you cannot modify child support. That's up to the court. You cannot modify that. The court could have included this provision in there, too. You can't modify child support, and you can't waive alimony or reduce alimony or modify alimony. The legislature didn't do that. They were silent, and I think that was in 1989. This court is the body through common law that said prenuptial agreements cannot waive alimony. That was the law of this court. And I think that this court can, under the common law, say that there are good public policy reasons since Conley and that the overwhelming authority throughout the country by commentators, judges, legal scholars is that these agreements should be favored so that people can sort out their own affairs.
Your time has expired.
I understand, and I think this court can do that. Your Honor, can I have 1 minute to address Thunderstick?
No. Mr. Welke, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Mr. Evans. Whatever the trend of judicial decisions in other jurisdictions may be with respect to the continuing validity of the rule that antenuptial agreements of this nature are void as against policy, public policy, we conclude that the provisions in question here are contrary to public policy expressed in our statutes. That's Connolly in 1978. And the two reasons that this court said that was unenforceable are not the two reasons that are being proffered in some of the briefs. One was that these tend to encourage divorce, and number two, what this court said is that that we are not going to allow people to contract away the obligations of statutes. And then in the final opinion, or the final part of it, part of this opinion of Connolly said, the tenor of our statutes and decisions that post-divorce obligation of a husband to support his ex-wife is affected with such a public interest that the parties in a divorce action may not conclusively agree upon the terms of future support. The same principle should be applied even more strictly in an antenuptial setting where, as pointed out in the Gundakoff case, conditions which affect a spouse's entitlement to alimony cannot be accurately foreseen. That's 1978 written by this court. And I don't think that the wisdom of the court's words by then Chief Justice Wollman have eroded with the passage of time. There is no more provincial or colloquial laws that this court enforces than its domestic relations laws. Whatever may happen in the other states, and if you go through and look at those litany of 41 states and what happens, you'll see a variety of historical happenings that occurred. Legislative changes occurred in some of those states. Decisions were changed by some of them, and each jurisdiction had its own unique look at its domestic relations laws. This court's not bound by any. This court sets the compass, the calculus for what the marital relationships will be in South Dakota. And basically it comes down to, are you going to allow people to act with impunity during the divorce? Mr. Sanford, there is no more sophisticated businessman that exists than Mr. Sanford. He runs a multi-million dollar empire. He looked at this agreement, and he had a choice. His lawyer drafted it. And he had a choice as to which state to pick. This man had multiple properties. He had Minnesota, Arizona, all that might have been more favorable than the law that then existed in South Dakota. He chose the South Dakota law. He chose to push the envelope with the settled law to not to segregate property and alimony. Not to say, if he wanted to change the law, he clearly should have said, so much is allocated to property and so much to alimony, he could have retained the severability had he done that. But he took that risk. And the negotiations that took place, as Mr. Evans was explaining, were not, the two lawyers were negotiating in the dark. They did not see the value and the wealth of Mr. Sanford. The template, as I indicated in my opening remarks, was the non-marital agreement. The negotiations were taking place were nits and gnats to that non-marital agreement. But the substantive net worth was not seen by anybody, but that except a day prior to the agreement was signed.
But neither the lawyer for your client nor your client asked for more time.
No, they did not, Your Honor. And what is my client to do? I mean, at that
was there any testimony that she was saying she had to sign it that day or not, or that
the testimony was not that day, but this agreement, Justice Sabers. She had to sign this agreement. I mean, what's happening here is that she was going home and they were having arguments and what is this and what's that. She's planning for a wedding. The invitations have been out. There's two receptions planned. They're going this. And he's at home saying, what are you doing? What is she supposed to do? She's supposed to sign this agreement. And she just says, sign it. Her lawyer says it's unenforceable. That's what he wants. I'm moving on. That's what we have for the facts. She's represented by counsel, but those are the facts.
What about the fact, I mean, that she was living with him for 8 years? I mean, that certainly would suggest that she had to have better than usual knowledge of the assets and situation between the parties here.
Not in the context of this case, Your Honor, you would think that, but she was not one that was involved in the day-to-day affairs of that. I mean, she knew that they lived a very a lifestyle only known by a few people. She didn't know, you know, she knew he owned a bunch of banks. They had multiple dwellings, but whether it was a sub-S corporation and what the intricate holdings were and what the value, she had no idea. She just knew that she was living with a man that she was going to be with, and that they had a lifestyle that was exceedingly wealthy lifestyle. She didn't know any of the details. Why would she ask? I mean, she was being provided for. They were going. She left a career that she had because he has a style that none of us ever have that can go any place in the world at any time. And he wanted her, and in fairness, to go with him whenever she wanted to go, wherever he wanted to go. It was a lifestyle that none of us, at least in this room, can say that we've been accustomed to. The question, though, from the policy standpoint is, what has my client done on the facts of this case? She's been a faithful and devoted spouse. She has seen her partner be involved in adultery. She's been subject to verbal and physical abuse. What are the message are you sending when you say you can contract away alimony and now you can act with impunity? Whatever you want to do, as long as you get a lawyer to look at it, send something that this court will say that's okay. And that's what it really comes down to. Are you going to let that be the law of the state, that one can act with impunity throughout the divorce and not have to support? And is your message to people that are drafting prenuptial agreements, if you're going to draft them that they're going to be enforceable with the law. And if you push the envelope, you have a risk that this court is going to find them void and unenforceable. He took a calculated business risk. He's a sophisticated person, represented by a sophisticated lawyer. They pushed the envelope. And why did they? They didn't have to do that. But he wanted all the economic consequences of this relationship determined.
Isn't that simply prudent planning by his counsel, that this court may sometime in the future reverse its policy that existed at the time of the document that it was void as to alimony?
It would have been prudent planning, Chief Justice, had they bifurcated it, and to say, I'm going to protect your net worth by these payments under property, and I'm going to say also that the payments for alimony are this. That would have been prudent planning. What was done was to push the envelope and allow you not to make that severability issue. As Justice Konenkamp indicated, I suggest that one reasonable cursed person cannot discern how much is there, and especially when you look at this agreement with these, I call them bizarre provisions of who started the divorce and who's at fault and somebody gets less depending on what it is bizarre. I don't know why all of that was there. It didn't need to be. You've never addressed those issues. A simple agreement of saying, here are your financial statements, this much is property, and then if they wanted to push the envelope on alimony, it would have been a clear picture for this court to say yes or no. Now, they have not given you a choice. In my view, they have given you an issue that's convoluted in an agreement in which you and I are supposed to look back and Justice Amundson and try to divine what this means. I think under the facts of this case and how it happened, that the court doesn't have any alternative but to declare it void and enforceable, to remand it back to Justice Amundson to do what every trial judge is, to make an equitable determination of alimony and property. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Welk. The court will be in recess until 10 o'clock. Thank you.